This is Climate One, changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. Today, we'll hear about one American institution that's reducing its carbon footprint in some surprising places, on the football field, the basketball court, and even the racetrack.
More than three-quarters of NASCAR fans are aware that, you know, climate change is an issue. And so NASCAR has, I think, like 80 million fans. And so if you're able to articulate the importance of doing your own part to offset that, that's a huge impact.
On today's Climate One, we'll meet team owners, athletes, and others who are working to reduce their major league carbon impact and to share that win with their fans.
While not everyone is interested in science, many people are interested in sports. So if we can use our platform to do things that create real change, even on a micro level, that's something we're going to do.
The greening of professional sports, up next on Climate One. What happens when Friday night lights go solar? This is Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. Climate One conversations with oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, are recorded before a live audience and hosted by Greg Dalton.
I'm Greg Dalton, and this is Climate One on the road. I'm standing in the entrance to the Golden One Center, the first LEED Platinum Arena in the NBA, and brand new home of the Sacramento Kings basketball team. We're here for the annual meeting of the Green Sports Alliance, a group of executives from the NFL, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, even NASCAR. They're here sharing ideas for reducing food waste, running stadiums on clean energy, and encouraging fans to reduce their carbon impact. Let's go down to the locker room to learn how professional sports teams are getting skin in the game.
Sports plays a role in culture. Always has, always will. Government is intended to represent, not lead.
Justin Zillner is executive director of the Green Sports Alliance, a group of professional teams and venues.
So I'll give you an example. What Jackie Robinson, the inclusion of baseball, what it did on race relations alone in America, not only here but globally, is a good example of culturally the significance of what sport could represent. You can talk about Billie Jean King, you can talk about Muhammad Ali. So in my role and perspective, I started my sports industry work in the snow sports industry and watched the ski industry, in my opinion, the canary in the coal mine to a certain degree, go from 125 days a year to 190 to 60 to 30 to zero. So I got out of the ski industry knowing that there was sort of an end run there, but I wanted to do something that was significant in nature and started working for the Portland Trailblazers, the NBA Portland Trailblazers. And obviously Portland has a culture of sort of environmental stewardship. And we started doing some really great work in that. And we established a carbon footprint, for example. We were the first team to do that. And then we started saying, like, look, we're going to make massive changes. It's going to actually erode that footprint, engage with people. Meanwhile, the Mariners were doing some great stuff. The Seahawks were doing some great stuff. Another Paul Allen-owned team.
How much of this was driven by Paul Allen? Or is it brought to him? Or does he really have it in his belly and DNA to be green?
I think what you'll find is that most wealthy individuals, whether those be, you know, individuals that are just out there in culture or they're ones that own sports teams, seem to have a philanthropic nature to them, whether that was born with it or they were blessed by certain resources and decided, I'm going to do more with my money. I'm going to do more with my influence. What you found with Paul Allen is that he's an incredible philanthropist. He's got his own organization that works with that. That's Vulcan Philanthropy, and he's got a foundation. Before coming over as the executive director of the Green Sports Alliance, I was working for Paul Allen up in Seattle and doing philanthropic work. And absolutely, and I've met a lot of owners out there of teams that they want to do the right thing. And so there's a lot of things they do in ocean conservation or land conservation or elephant conservation, food principles, all those kinds of things. LeBron James stands up at the ESPYs and says, look, we have an incredible influence. We know that. So if we know that and assume that, what can we do? What role can we play socially? And let's get involved. And he stood up with some of his friends So let's challenge people to get involved, whether it's race, whether it's environment, whether it's another social cause. So these owners do want to get engaged. And so, yes, absolutely. Paul Allen Inspire, the largest solar project still in the state of Washington, is sitting on one of his buildings up in Seattle. What the Portland Trailblazers were to do to inspire really an entire global population of sports industry took notice to what the Blazers were doing in Portland. So we got that energy. We harnessed that energy of all those teams. There were six of us got together and said, should we do something at scale? Could we take what we're doing and learn from that, but also educate other people, inspire other people, provide some resources to get this launched into something even greater? We had no idea necessarily it was going to become a global movement, but at the time we felt that it was going to be an opportunity to do more and scale this and actually make more impact. So we put together this organization called the Green Sports Alliance. We're now nearly 500 strong. We're growing pretty rapidly. There's actually green sports sort of organizations popping up into other countries around the globe. We're working on harmonizing all of that right now, but you're really talking about this at scale. This is energy and water and waste and transportation and food and all the things that go into sort of what some environmentalists call a carbon footprint, but really it's just about doing business at the end of the day. How do we do business and how do we get better over time to do that? How do we have a smaller ecological footprint and participate in the healthy communities that we all live in and play in? And that's what our mission is. That's what we're trying to do. And so it really has been an incredible momentum at this point. But that's not where the impact is. And so today's summit that we're having here in Sacramento, Golden One Center, in this beautiful building that's actually one of the most ecological buildings on the planet, we're here to talk about what's next. The future is fan and community athlete engagement. How do we actually properly engage and use this power and harness this energy to ask people to join? It doesn't matter if you're a race car fan or a tennis fan or a surfing, or a surfer or a skier. How do we get everybody to join us in this so that we can get to those tipping points that have been elusive for the last really five decades and get us to those tipping points where we're actually Americans, even if you were just to look at us here in our own country, where solar is king, where renewable energy is the right thing, and local and organic foods is the right approach. Those are the tipping points, right? How do we get there? We're close, but could sport just give a little nudge here and get us over that?
But a lot of companies, it's one thing to reduce operations. What you're really talking about is reducing waste, which saves money. So cheaper energy, less waste, those are all good business decisions.
Great business decisions.
But what you're talking about is a step further, which is often a very uncomfortable place for companies to go, which is telling their customers what they should do or how they should behave. And isn't that, particularly in these times, a delicate place to tell, your customers, who you want them to buy tickets. Sponsors get a little sensitive about being eco-righteousness or, telling people they should not eat meat or drive a certain kind of car. That's a delicate place, isn't it?
It's the role that sports is willing to put on its shoulders. What we've heard prominently over and over again in my lifetime is that sports has played a role in defining culture and defining what our societal norms will be. And they're very willing and engaging to do that. Again, I mentioned that this is a pretty young movement. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been around for 100 years. And it's just now got to that point where people are very comfortable starting to talk about that. And part of it is, there's this notion of sort of greenwashing that's out there. It's like, okay, well, what I found in the very beginning, I was pretty eager in my professional career and saw there was this shining light that I could see. And I was really eager to get all teams and all leagues and all brands to just go. But the reality was they really wanted to make sure their own house was in order first, because you don't want to go out and start telling people, hey, you know what you should do. We've got three great ideas for you. In fact, join us on those three ideas. And then as an owner or an executive of an arena, team, a stadium, or whatever it might be, you open up the paper and there it is. There's the story that says such and such organization is asking for fans to take action, but look at their own arena. Look at their own operation. They're not there yet. So it was important that we took the time in order to educate people, bring more resources, and that's what the Green Sports Alliance does, is bring all that, inspire people to take action, but more importantly, how are they going to do it? So now you're seeing that bar has been raised. People are doing the right thing, and nobody's perfect. There is no perfect here. There's just getting better over time. And as long as they're getting better, then they can go out and you can say, this is what we're doing. So a good example, NHL has released a sustainability report, and every year they're going to be kind of updating that and see where they're at. They know they're not perfect. Pocono Raceway, NASCAR, just released a sustainability report. They know they're not perfect. But what they've said is, this is where we're at, and we are charged to get better.
And they have a huge solar array outside that racetrack.
It's an incredible place. Like, you know, but solar isn't the only key. You don't just do solar and say we're done, right? You know, right. So you try to figure out, how am I going to compost? How am I going to recycle? But more importantly, how are we going to engage the fans? So even, you know, even at Pocono there, you know, there's two races that NASCAR, you know, and the up and coming race was called, you know, the green. It's called the Pocono Green 250. And it's actually, the whole thing is about, how do you label, brand, educate fans on what environmental stewardship's about? That's where the impact becomes really, really magnificent.
Justin, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here.
The greening of professional sports is reaching into one of the dirtiest sports in the reddest parts of the country. NASCAR CEO Brian France endorsed Donald Trump for president, and several NASCAR drivers sent joyful tweets after the election. Since then, the Trump administration has tried to roll back the move from fossil fuels to cleaner energy and denied climate change is happening. But I spoke with one NASCAR driver who accepts climate reality and thinks the sport could do more to reduce its environmental impact. Her story is not the typical path to the big oval. Here's my conversation with Julia Landauer.
So, Julia, what is a woman raised in New York, educated at Stanford, doing behind the wheel of a stock car?
I love going fast. You know, my parents were looking for an activity that their kids could do together on the weekends, and they specifically wanted something their girls could do against boys. And so it was me and my sister at first, and then my brother. So I started racing go-karts, and I loved it right away, and I started winning right away. So I thought, I want to be a race car driver. Other people are doing it. Why can't I? And so that's how it got started, and we just kind of been climbing the ranks ever since. But it's always been fun to be the different race car driver.
So you've been a path breaker in a very male-dominated sport.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been really cool to see more girls get into the lower ranks of racing recently, and we are seeing a big jump in that. It's not 50-50 yet, but we're getting closer. And it's been cool to be, you know, from New York City and just have a very different cultural perspective and then bring that to racing, but then still prove to the teams and to my competitors that at the end of the day, I'm a racer, and there's that respect that way, even though I'm packaged so differently. So it's been fun. It's been tough at times, but it's been fun.
And you studied STEM, science, technology. Tell me about what you studied at Stanford.
Yeah, so I got a Bachelor's of Science in Science, Technology, and Society, and it was very interdisciplinary, and it allowed me to take a lot of mechanical engineering design classes, as well as some computer science, and then some communication and business-oriented classes, and history, you know, when you're trying to be, you know, one of the few women to go after a racing career and try to be successful, and not many people have done it, it's good to know, you know, other groundbreakers in history, so just trying to be as prepared as possible.
Was there a moment where you had an environmental or climate awakening where you realized that the environment was something that would really be important to you in your lifetime?
Yeah, and well, it started at home. Like, we've always recycled. We've always been environmentally friendly at home. And then when I got to Stanford and I saw just how much more there was out there, I became really interested in figuring out how, not only for my personal life, how I could be more environmentally friendly, but then from a racing perspective, you know, I'm very aware that there are emissions that the sport has, and that's a very real part of it. But there are so many things that can be done to offset that or to try to, you know, negate the negative stuff. But and to work with NASCAR and to do stuff on a personal level, it was all coming together at Stanford. And I was able to talk with people at the sustainability office there just to brainstorm ideas and to see, you know, if you're looking at NASCAR from the outside, what could be done to make it better. And it's a lot of stuff that NASCAR is doing right now. So it was cool to see that all come together.
I went to my first NASCAR race a couple of years ago at Sonoma, and seemed like everything was combusted. The food was barbecued and blackened, and the rubber was burning and the fuel was burning. There's lots that seemed like combustion was at the center of it. And scientists at Stanford say that combustion of fossil fuels is a real problem. So how do you reconcile those two?
Oh, for sure. And it is a problem. And I don't think anyone's trying to say that doesn't exist, but really just trying to say, okay, what steps can we take to try to offset that? How can we be better? How can we address the issue? You know, more than 3/4 of NASCAR fans are aware that, you know, climate change is an issue. And so being able to inspire people to change their day-to-day lives. I mean, NASCAR has many millions, I think like 80 million fans. And so if you're able to articulate the importance of doing your own part to offset that, that's a huge impact. And so it may not be directly at the track all the time, but it's if you can influence 80 million people to maybe recycle or be a little bit greener in their day-to-day life, that definitely helps.
Do you talk with environmental climate things when you're, I don't know, having a beer with the other drivers? Do those sorts of issues come up, the sustainability, or is that something kind of just that a few people at the corporate office talk about?
No, I mean, I think it comes up. And, you know, the drivers I've hung out with both at my level at K&N and at the Cup level, I mean, it definitely comes up because we're conscious of what we're doing, and we know that we have a sport that we love very much that, you know, has some other consequences. And I think discussing it is it's not just in the select group of people. And for me, it's fun with all of my non-racing networks that I have to be uh-huh. able to kind of convey, okay, we're not just a really backward sport. We're actually, you know, doing what we can in the parameters that are there to make a difference and to try to make some positive change.
Formula One racing has Formula E, which is all electric. And some people associate the very dramatic sounds of auto racing with kind of the appeal of the sport. I talked to a person from Harley Davidson once who said, we can make an electric bike, but it doesn't have that Harley sound. And our customers want that Harley sound. So do you think that racing can be successful without those dramatic roars of the engines?
I think that's a great question. I totally understand the really gritty appeal of the smells and the sounds. And I think that's a part of racing. And I don't necessarily think that electric is the only answer to make racing more environmentally friendly, but I do understand those concerns that it might not touch the really those types of core fans. And as someone who agrees that, again, I like the smell, I like the, you know, the sounds, but I just try not to look at it in black and white, because nothing's black and white, right? So yes, you could do a full electric series. Would that, you know, lose some fans? Maybe, but I don't know, I don't look at it in black and white like that.
So what are some of the steps you'd like to see racing take in terms of the next fuel or you know, greening the sport? If you were the green czar of NASCAR, what would you
want? Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to see, like, continued improvement in the direction we're going. You know, right now we have, you know, the percentage of ethanol blend. You know, how far can you push that with the real restraints that, you know, we have motors that need to, you know, stay cool, and that's a big thing with the cooling, you know, not getting the motors to run too hot. But I think just really continuing to harness the fact that we have really engaged fans and, you know, seeing the impact we can make with them, because at the end of the day, I think that's a much bigger picture than, and that can have the ripple effect much more than just the sport itself. And I'm speaking as a driver, right? I don't work in NASCAR corporate. I don't work with NASCAR and the partners, but just from a driver's perspective, it seems like we can push a little bit more of the fuel and, you know, maybe start experimenting with different materials for the race cars. And but I think the more we can make immediate change with the people who are involved, I think that will help escalate the other processes.
Autonomous cars are all the rage in Silicon Valley. A lot of that's coming out of Silicon Valley. A lot of drivers are being worried about put out of work. Do you ever think we'll watch autonomous race cars?
I don't know. I mean, I think from a technology standpoint, it'd be super cool. But part of racing is that we're kind of like superheroes who are doing things that the average person can't do. And I think that aspect is really what brings people back. Like, it's fun to watch cars go really fast and see what they're capable of. But to know that another person is, you know, piloting the race car is what I think really gains the attention. So I'd love to see, like, maybe an autonomous pace car or something, like, to lead the field to green. I think that'd be really cool. But I think I like having drivers, because then you have the rivalries, and then you have, you know,
personality, the human
drama that carries for the full season. It's like you got to race against these people every race, so the drama continues.
So what do you drive off the track, and how often do you get tickets?
My parents gave me a Volkswagen GTI when I moved down to North Carolina, so that's what I'm still driving. And I got my tickets out of the way when I was younger, and I learned that you need to set cruise control if you do not want to get a ticket. So I've been doing pretty well so far, but a 5-lane highway shouldn't be a 60-mile-an-hour zone, which I learned early on. But that's okay. It's fun.
Well, Julia Landauer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julia Landauer is a 2-time championship-winning NASCAR driver. When we come back, Greg Dalton speaks with former World Series champion Dusty Baker about managing both the Washington Nationals and his own solar energy company.
I didn't have a job in baseball, and I started thinking, I said, man, if nobody wants me on their team, then I'll start my own team. And so I started Baker Energy Team.
This is Climate One.
Everybody get up, it's time to slam now. We got a real jam going down. Welcome to the Space Jam. Here's your chance, do your dance at the Space Jam. All right.
This is Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. You can listen to all of our programs and subscribe to our podcast at our website, climateone.org. This week, we're exploring the greening of American sports with movers, shakers, drivers, and hitters at the Green Sports Alliance Summit in Sacramento. Here's Greg Dalton.
Washington Nationals manager Dusty Baker is a baseball lifer. A consistent hitter during his playing days, he's become one of the most successful modern-day managers. He's also winning off the field with his latest venture, solar energy.
When I heard that you have a clean energy company, a solar company, I was surprised. What inspired you to start a solar energy company?
Well, what inspired me was that when I built my home almost 11 years ago, I talked to my neighbor next door, and he had a monthly bill of like $2,500. And I was like, man, that's ridiculous. And so I have, you know, a pretty large home, but I have a well. I have, some outbuildings out there. And I said, man, that's going to be ridiculous. And I started looking into solar. And my dad was always into fishing and hunting and started us and, you know, clean water and things. And so I says, well, since I'm building this home, I put solar on my barn in the back. And then it wasn't quite enough. And then I end up having a ground mount, behind my vineyard that I end up planting. And then I looked into solar power on my well, and then I looked into, with thermal, heating, for my water. And then I was like, man, this is pretty interesting. And then I really start seeing the effects of, zero bills. And then I didn't have a job in baseball, and I started thinking, I said, man, if nobody wants me on their team, then I'll start my own team. And so I started Baker Energy Team with a couple guys, that I had gone to high school and college with, and, they were up to speed in solar. And so one thing led to another, and I said, hey, and then I went 2 years before that. I was in Chicago, and I met a guy named Ted Roth with Roth Partnerships, and him and his brother Byron, they were big in the energy. They knew all the people from, all the solar companies and all the inverter companies, and they put on these big conventions. So I went down to Las Vegas, and I saw that there were probably a handful of minorities there out of like 10,000-15,000 people, and I was like, man, this is a perfect, segue for me. It was really intriguing to me, because especially the fact that I was afraid of electricity as a kid, because I stuck my dad's screwdriver and light socket and it turned all black, and then I lied to him. I got a whip and then I lied to him. I don't know who did it, and he knew who did it, and I knew who did it. And so, like you want to approach and attack your phobias in life. And so that was another reason why. So one thing led to another, and here we are. And one key fact is that as my company was growing and I took this job again back in baseball, I was like, well, how am I going to do this from afar? And I called Joe Gibbs, former Washington Redskins head coach. And he was out 11 years when he came back, and he had Joe Gibbs Racing. So I called Mr. Gibbs. I didn't know him. I had somebody to put me in contact with him. And he told me how to do it and weekly reports and things that I'd have to, but he told me I'd have to stay on top of it, have people that I trusted. And then at the end, he said, let me pray for you, pray with you. And I was like, sure, Mr. Gibbs. And so, yeah, he said a prayer, for me and my new career with the Nationals, and also for my company. And I found that very enlightening.
Well, you're at the Washington National Stadium, which was the first pro sports stadium to be LEED certified, have a green certification. And you have a partnership with a company that is involved with the Golden One Center, which is the LEED Platinum. That's supposed to be the greenest sports center in the country. So what do you see in terms of in professional sports getting into solar, getting into cleaner energy? Do fans care?
I think some of the fans care. I think fans care in certain areas more than others, and I think there are other people that really believe that we have to clean up, the carbon waste, in the country. I mean, there are some fans that don't even believe in global warming, because I see signs on their cars and different things, and I said, and I believe in that. And I've talked to some scientist friends of mine that I went fishing with, and they were in Alaska for the last 4 or 5 years, and they've told me about, how they've seen, the ocean rise, only a couple inches, but a couple inches all over the world, man, that's a lot. And they've seen glaciers melting and different things, and there are people that don't believe it, and I'm not a doomsdayer, but I believe, what I'm seeing and what I'm reading. And I believe as a fisherman and outdoorsman, I can see, especially, in the places where there are a lot of industry where we're dumping into our rivers. I mean, we've cleaned up a lot of it, but there are a whole bunch of places I've gone and seen that has that stench about it, or I wouldn't drink the water, or I wouldn't dare eat the fish out of the water. And I love eating fish. Or I'll go someplace and I'll be out in the woods and you'll see, dead animals, and different things. And, we must preserve, the world. And if I can do just a little part, to help, help the world and then support my family at the same time, that's what I'm willing to do.
Last question. A lot of the people who will feel climate change first and worst are poor people of color. They live close to the factories, the refineries, et cetera. There's more racial tension in America. You saw that in Atlanta when you were there with Hank Aaron. So
I see it now sometimes. I don't think people overlook that. But there's tension out there. Not necessarily racial tension like there was before, but there's tension, I think, between the haves and the have-nots. And I think that And if something's not done and we don't share and make it available to them, then people will eventually take what they need, which is equals violence.
Thanks for your time, Dusty Baker.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. We're talking about the greening of American sports. We bring it on as a consulting firm working to clean up live entertainment and sports. Jennifer Regan is their chief sustainability officer. She got her professional start in an unusual place.
I was raised in Santa Monica, California. My parents were divorced, but my dad was this. Everything he did with me was about educating me about the environment. Every weekend trip was camping. Santa Monica was one of the first cities with recycling. Heal the Bay, which is a great nonprofit. Same year I was born, 1985. I'm a younging. So my dad brought me to every beach cleanup possible. I mean, I was raised thinking in LA that I was the most environmental person. I went to college in Oregon because I wanted to study sustainable development and I wanted to go study indigenous cultures. And Willamette University had a program that worked with indigenous cultures. And the reason I cared about that is because I thought they were the true environmentalist, that indigenous people understood the plight of fighting for natural resources because it was a part of their way of life. So I had innocently romanticized this notion that I needed to fight for the Amazon and fight for these places with the indigenous people. So I went to college thinking I was the most environmental person because I recycled and I went camping. And then I got schooled by the Oregonian culture, where recycling and camping is what you do before age 2, and then you start learning about supply chain and veganism and other ways of reducing your impact. So in undergrad, my mind was just blown open. My heart was blown open. I went from just looking at saving the Amazon to really look at sustainable development and what was the environmentalist way. And how could I include as many people as possible in saving the earth?
And then you went to work for the Anschutz family, a billionaire with an oil and gas fortune, an unusual place to be an environmental leader.
Yeah. When I graduated in 2007, I had just finished working for the Oregon League of Conservation Voters on a campaign to have mayors sign the Climate Action Pact that came with the Inconvenient Truth. 2007, there were some businesses adding environment to the job, but there were three sustainability jobs on the market, and I was not eligible for them. So I was looking at other businesses, and I had a family connection to AEG, my mother, and she said, "Why don't you get another job at AEG and bring the environment in?" And I said to her, "No, I've got to have an environmental job." And like a stubborn millennial, what was beautiful is that in my passionate explanation of why I wanted to be an environmental person, my mom heard for the first time how knowledgeable I'd become. And right after that conversation, she had been asked to join a green committee at her company. So beautiful combination of passion and connection. She said to her executive team, "Hey, can I bring in my daughter to give us a little bit of information on what we should be looking at on this green committee?" And I used air quotes for everyone. Green committee, had no idea what green meant. And I went in for this one dinner to explain the difference between green and sustainable and say that they had to go big or go home. And they offered me a 2-month position to assist this committee in getting all the information together for a proposal to the owner. One of which included you need to hire someone full time. When I got that recommendation approved, I went to the market and started emailing my professors and emailing everyone saying, "You've got to help me find a person for this job." And one of my male professors, and it's important because I'll mention this later, wrote back, "I have a recommendation." And in it, he wrote, "You." And then he bullet pointed all the reasons why my personality meant that I was ready for the job and I needed to take the plunge, even if I didn't feel experienced. And so I worked while I built my career, also building the greening program for AEG at the same time.
And AEG operates and owns sports and entertainment complexes around the world.
They are the largest presenter of live entertainment in the world. They own sports teams like the LA Kings hockey team. They own arenas. They also have contracts to manage arenas. So they have over 150 stadiums, arenas, and music theaters across the world. And they have a whole music division that does Coachella Music Festival, that does Golden Voice concerts. And so a lot of the big acts that you see or buy tickets, anything you can buy a ticket to, AEG is involved in.
And Philip Anschutz was also on the board of the American Petroleum Institute, which has been kind of slow down and block progress on climate that you've been working so hard on. Did you ever encounter any contradictions or pushback on or places you thought it was not comfortable to go because of the oil and gas history of the company? And
thank you for that. My rhetoric 100% was about best business case and efficiency. I could not talk about climate change as my business case in 07 and 08. Right. My part of my job was to really educate and create a level of comfortability among the executives and really looking at climate change. So my key to success in the beginning was looking at all the benefits of climate change without necessarily calling it climate change.
So you don't talk about the cause. Use business language.
Yeah.
It's in American culture, more people pay attention to sports than the news or politics.
Yeah.
What do you see as the opportunity for American sports to bring about a cultural change? We're not seeing political leadership change at the national level. Currently, right now, there's a revival of climate denialism. What can sports do to move things forward on clean energy at this time?
Mr. Anschutz and his entire executive team moved their position and came to a place of accepting climate change, because not only through AEG, but Mr. Anschutz purchased Xanterra National Parks and Resorts and got there one of the leaders in environmental park management. And he also invested in a wind farm. And when he was bringing these experts in front of him, the information, the way it was being delivered, it became very clear. And so his executive team are some of the Anschutz Corporation, some of the biggest advocates at any of their companies on behalf of the environment. And so I think what I can learn from that and answer the question about sports is that sports is about high performance. And one of the things that many executives in sports talk about is the moment of truth. You come to an event to experience the impossible, the moment that someone hits a 3-point shot 10 seconds before the buzzer, or when the score is, you know, we go overtime and someone wins from behind. And those are the moments that you really long for, or you hear your favorite musician hit a note in person that you've never felt in your body before. And I even see you lighting up when I'm telling you this, and I'm assuming the audience, just feel it in your body. There's movement, there's passion, there's connection. And so if you're in the stadium or in the arena experiencing that, and you're connecting on that level, and you can also learn something else in a way that in that excitement, that energy, it could connect to you on that heartfelt way. And I feel that as we explored it as a business and we saw the fan engagement components and the sponsors respond, the sponsors, big brands like Coke and ESPN, I mean, they're already getting pressure from their industry to make these changes. So for sports to meet them there, and then for us to get back to that passion, that excitement, sports is the opportunity to tell the story of high performance, that magical moment. And if that magical moment can be us coming together as people, as fans, to celebrate a team that win, or us winning climate change. And so for those of us in the environment, it's not a far leap to think about us celebrating our wins as a community at our community gathering place. So for us, arenas and stadiums are the places where community gather. And sports are the things that the high performance wins that we celebrate.
Last question. We live in a time where the revival of fossil fuels, climate science is under attack. Fossil fuels are, talk about trying to bring back the coal industry. Does that ever get you discouraged, or does that get you more energized?
People always told me as I get older, I'm going to get more conservative or I'm going to get more cynical. And what I find, I feel a disconnect. I feel numb, and I think that's my avoidance because it hurts that much. So the answer question, do I feel discouraged? I feel overwhelmed, and I don't like to admit that too often because I'm capable of a lot of things. But it's overwhelming because it really feels like there are more people who believe in the micro actions to take to solve climate change. A lot of people agree with them. And so the fact that we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and I really want us to get talking on a smaller scale, the personal scale, so we can stop throwing everything out. And so for me, when I say overwhelmed, it's overwhelming to hear all of these great progressive movements states have taken, policies that are just being tossed out because we have a national statement about no climate change.
Jenna Regan, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Jennifer Regan is Chief Sustainability Officer at We Bring It On. Greg Dalton caught up with her at the annual meeting of the Green Sports Alliance. Next up, how the Sacramento Kings built a LEED-certified stadium from a recycled mall. This is Climate One. This is Climate One, taking the show on the road. Greg Dalton is speaking with athletes, team owners, and executives at the Green Sports Alliance Summit in Sacramento to find out what the wide world of sports is doing to lighten its carbon footprint.
The NBA Sacramento Kings recently opened the Golden One Center. It sits in the heart of California's capital city and is the first LEED-certified platinum indoor sports venue in the country. We spoke with team president Chris Granger about the team's commitment to sustainability.
Well, honestly, when we started this project here in Sacramento, we surveyed 20,000 of our fans and non-fans. We did about 100 different focus groups. And the number one thing that people wanted outside of a championship banner was for Golden One Center to be a model of sustainability. So this is something that really matters to our community. And as you know, much of the green policy of our country starts right here in Sacramento. So as with everything in this building, we wanted to do something that reflects the values of Sacramento, reflects the people of Sacramento, and being green really is important to us here. So from our standpoint, we wanted to push it as far as we could and embrace solar since we have so much sunshine here in Sacramento. We wanted to be mindful of drought conditions here in California. And all of those things in totality led us to being LEED Platinum. I don't know that that was the initial goal, but certainly it was the end result of everything we did.
How much did it cost to go LEED Platinum? A lot of people go LEED, well, maybe LEED Gold. How much extra did you pay?
I'm not even sure I could answer it because there are things that made sense for us operationally. So there are certain cost advantages from being as efficient as we are going to be going forward. And quite honestly, there's revenue opportunities. We have uncovered a whole host of partners and sponsors who want to participate in the greenest building in the world. So I'm not so sure this isn't a net positive for us rather than a cost for us.
I go to sports games and often look into the recycling or compost bin, and I see stuff in the wrong place. And there's a little bit of cynicism out there that recycling really gets recycled, whether compost really gets composted. And so if I come here and put a beer bottle in the compost, what happens?
We'll find it. We'll find it before it goes where it needs to go. But it critically matters for us here. And I think one of the neater things we've done here on that topic is not just in terms of recycling. You know, this project sits on an old mall that we demolished, and literally 99% of that mall was recycled, much of it back into Golden One Center. So we take recycling very seriously. And similarly, we take our food process very similarly. So we're really trying to be zero waste here in across everything we do.
Some sports franchises just wanted to do a little bit of greenwashing. When you look around other professional sports areas, do you see greenwashing happening?
Sure, without question. But that said, it's a process. It's a process for all of us. And certainly we like to be on the leading edge of that. But again, I think part of our mission here with the Kings is just to get the conversation going. To be the first lead platinum gives us an opportunity to speak with some authenticity about here are the varied ways you can make a difference in your building. And they don't all have to be epically earth-changing ideas, but let's get everybody started because, again, we all know in sports that we have a tremendous platform and people pay attention to what we do. So to the extent that we can create a conversation among fans, among partners, among suppliers, it really makes a difference. And again, just think about the number of people, the number of companies and brands who touch sports, from transportation to energy to food to retail. If we can affect those partners, if we can affect those companies in that supply chain, we really can impact a lot of the economy here. So we take our role as a sports purveyor of sustainability very seriously.
Sometimes green is perceived as being controversial, particularly these days. It didn't used to be the case. President Nixon established the EPA. But lately, green has become polarized by, like everything else. Are corporate sponsors, team owners kind of reluctant to be green because it's become political, at least in Washington?
I don't know. It's certainly not our story here in Sacramento, from Vivek Ranadive, our owner, to obviously Governor Brown here at the state capitol. Green is important, and the science is very clear about climate change right now. So again, we understand that, you know, while not everyone is interested in science, most people are interested in sports. So if we can use our platform to tell a green message, to do things that create real change, even on a micro level, that's something we're going to do.
How about the athletes? It's one thing for stadiums to be green, but it's another thing for athletes, who people who are revered, adored, they're icons. Do you need to do anything to get the athletes out there? Because they have such social power.
They certainly do. And again, I think that's what's important and what we message to our team here in Sacramento. Like, we want to make a difference in the world as an organization. So one of the things we work with our players on, we have a whole series of programs through something that's called Kings Academy, where we introduce our players to some of the things we do in the community. We introduce them to the values that we espouse here at Golden One Center. So again, from our standpoint, it's just an ongoing conversation. It's an ongoing education process about what you as an individual can do to make a difference.
I asked Vivek Ranadive, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and owner of the Sacramento Kings, if government is needed to solve the climate challenge or if it's something business and individuals can do.
Yeah, my daughter, for Father's Day many years ago, she gave me a poster with all her favorite sayings, and right at the top was Gandhi's saying, "Be the change you want to be." And that had an impact on me. And I thought that, you know, we can do things ourselves. I've always said that it's about more than basketball, that it's bigger than basketball. And we had an opportunity here to set an example and set a bar that hadn't been achieved before. So I think that our kids are way smarter than us. They're way more evolved than us. They're way more conscious of the impact that we're having on the environment. And so they are the change that we want the world to be. And so I don't think that we have to wait for governments to do the right thing. Our kids are showing us the way, and each of us can do the right thing.
And now you led the building of the greenest arena in the NBA. So tell us why this is so green, and did it cost you more to do it?
Yeah, we actually, when we started this project, when I bought the team, I had made a personal commitment that I would have an arena built by 2017. And if I didn't, then they could take the team back from me. And now, thanks to the state, the governor, the city, we actually had a law passed that allowed us to expedite the building of the arena, and we got it done 1 year ahead of that milestone, and we finished a year ago. And from our perspective, it had to be iconic. It had to serve our fans in a way that had never been done before. But our fans, through a crowdsourced survey, also told us that being green was really important to them. So for us, being green wasn't just an afterthought. It wasn't, you have a house and you slap on some solar panels. Being green was a core objective, and it had to be green in every way. So how we built it, we used recycled materials. How we power it, it's renewable energy. How we feed our fans, it's all local food. How we cool it, it uses technology that makes the cooling a lot more efficient. Water, that's a big problem in our state. So we use half the water. So in every way, being green was a core principle for us. And people have this misconception that it's either a good business decision, it's good for fans, or it's green. And in our case, we found that being green was good for the fans and it was good for business. So we had a triple win on it. You know, it was green, it was a great fan experience, and it's actually been great for business.
A lot of team owners, professional sports team owners, their trophies, their toys. It sounds like you view this team as a tool for something else rather than just a rich man's plaything.
Yeah, I bought the team because I wanted to keep it in Sacramento. I was a co-owner of the Golden State Warriors at the time, and we had just finished turning the team around. We had been booed for a number of years, and we were finally starting to win. And I realized that without the team, our state capital really had nothing. It would be like ripping the heart out of the city. And I came to California with nothing, so everything I have I owe to this great state. Sacramento is our capital. And so for me, it was obviously we want to build a winning franchise and we want to have great success on the court. But we also want to, we have a mission statement. And the mission statement I laid out was that we build a winning franchise that enhances the lives of those it touches and makes the world a better place. So that's core to our mission. And so, of course, we want to win championships one day, but we also want to go about it the right way.
Make the world a better place. You grew up in India. India is a big part of the climate situation. How do you see India in the climate equation?
Yeah, so India very much wants to be viewed as a world leader, as a superpower. We have a relatively newish prime minister, and he wants to make have an impact on the world stage. And obviously, it's one of the largest countries out there. So I believe that the young people in India are no different than my daughter and the young people over here. They want to do the right thing. If you go to India, you see the pollution. It just comes at you from all directions, and it assaults your senses. And so you don't have to be shown the impact that we're having on the environment. It's there 24/7 for you to smell and feel and touch. So I believe that India will be not just a willing participant, but will be a leader as we move to this new world order.
So scientists say what business is doing, it's all good, but it's not happening fast enough. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm a huge optimist, and I have great belief in the power of innovation, the power of what young people can do. If you look at a lot of the things that people said would happen, just haven't happened. And so I believe that as long as we continue the focus, I'm optimistic that businesses will start changing. In Europe, it's already a fact that, you know, it's like if you go to offices in Europe during the summertime, it's pretty warm there because the temperature is that high. I did a lot of business with European companies. More than half my business was from outside the United States when I had a multi-billion-dollar software company, and many of the international and European clients would want to know our green policies in order to give us the business. So it wasn't enough to simply be the best software. I also had to show that we were responsible citizens in order to get the business. So I think that businesses are going to do the right thing.
Great. Well, thank you for being the change.
Well, thank you.
That was Vivek Ranadive, owner of the Sacramento Kings basketball team, speaking with Greg Dalton. You've been listening to Climate One on the Road from the annual meeting of the Green Sports Alliance at the Golden One Center in Sacramento. Greg also spoke with Justin Zuhlner of the Green Sports Alliance, champion NASCAR driver Julia Landauer, Washington Nationals manager Dusty Baker, Jennifer Regan of We Bring It On, and Chris Granger, former president of the Sacramento Kings. To hear all our Climate One conversations, subscribe to our podcast at our website, climateone.org, where you'll also find photos, video clips, and more. Also at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you podcast. Please leave a comment. We'd love to know what you think about our conversations on energy, food, water, technology, psychology, and more.
Climate One is a special project of the Commonwealth Club of California. Jane Ann Chen is the producer. Kelly Pennington directs our audience engagement. Carlos Manuel is our booker and associate producer. The audio engineer is William Bloom. Annie Chelsea and Devin Strolovich are the editors. I'm Greg Dalton, the executive producer and host. The Commonwealth Club CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Join us next time for a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. Climate One is presented in association with KQED Public Radio.